Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
No.
13-year-old Jana was getting edgy.
I don't think we should have the meeting at my house tomorrow.
Her friend Sheila looked at her sideways. It's been at everyone else's, and yours is closest to school. What's the trouble?
Well, it's just that...
Look, we don't care if your room's a mess, added Bethany. The club just needs a place to meet.
I know, Jana began again, but my dad is sort of...
Well, then let's meet when he's not around, Sheila suggested.
Well, that's part of the problem. Jana took a deep breath. Mom and I don't really know when he's going to be around. Sometimes he just shows up and then...
Then what?
Inquired Bethany. So he's early for dinner. Then he almost always gets angry. We just never know.
Jana's voice began to break.
We just never know what'll happen.
The girl's eyes widened. Maybe you should come home with me, Sheila volunteered.
No thanks, replied Jana, avoiding her gaze. My mom really needs me.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about the effects of domestic abuse on children? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest works with these kinds of troubles. Barbara J. Zakheim is the founder and president of the Greater Washington Jewish Coalition Against Domestic Abuse, or JACADA, which provides victim support services, community educational programming, and youth prevention training. In addition to her volunteer efforts for JACADA, she's president of Keith R. Scott Associates, LLC, a business development consulting firm. She's married to Ron Kleinfeld, and they share 6 children and 10 grandchildren. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Barbara.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me.
What would you say is the biggest overall myth about domestic abuse?
I think the biggest myth is that people see domestic abuse as a battered woman syndrome, as people being physically abused. And domestic abuse is a much larger problem than physical abuse. In fact, there are many forms of domestic abuse: emotional, psychological, financial, verbal, which is part of emotional abuse, sexual abuse. And I think the conventional wisdom out there is to look at domestic abuse as a man hitting a woman, hitting a significant other, his wife, but to look at domestic abuse as somebody emotionally destroying another individual's self-esteem and making them live in an emotionally confrontational household is not the general understanding of the problem.
What do you mean by financial abuse?
Financial abuse is a situation where one partner controls the finances and the other partner has absolutely no control. And in saying that, the real basis of domestic abuse is power and control. One partner exerting power and control over the other.
What's the main fear of children living in a situation where there's domestic abuse?
I think the main fear is really abandonment. Very often in abusive households, confrontations may lead to one or the other parent walking out for a short period, sometimes for a longer period, parent saying they're going to run away, being unaware of what hearing such conversation may have on the child. So apart from potential fears of being the next victim of abuse, and in so many cases, children are victims of abuse just like their parent, but abandonment is a major, major fear.
Barbara, what are some characteristics of a home environment where domestic abuse is taking place?
Perhaps I can best describe it as a place where people are living in a pressure cooker. It's a high-stress environment, and all sorts of manifestations of that stress can be exhibited. Statistics in the literature are saying that there are at least 3.3 million children annually that are at risk of exposure to parental violence. As many as 10 million teenagers are estimated to have been exposed to domestic abuse each year. We're talking about, as I said, everybody thinks of physical abuse, and that very often is the last manifestation of abuse. It may start off with verbal abuse, name-calling, emotional abuse, where somebody's self-esteem is starting and continues to be destroyed because of comments about their inadequacy, their inability to cope, their inability to provide. It could be a large number of factors that start working at the self-esteem. I mentioned financial abuse, where A mother may not have enough money to buy groceries, and the controlling parent may wonder why there's not enough food on the table and says you don't know how to manage the finances. It can be lack of coordinated discipline. So the parents are so caught up in their own emotional problems, and the parent that's exerting the abuse may be very, very rigid in terms of discipline, and the parent who is being abused may be trying to protect the child and become very, very lax with discipline. So conflicting signals. And in terms of seeing power and control issues in that household, you're going to see where the children start to exhibit certain signs of either identifying with the abuser or identifying with the victim. And the child is very much torn in that regard.
Sometimes the abuser is the woman.
The statistics show that domestic abuse is driven by the female in about 6% of cases. That's a statistic that's been around for several years. I don't know if there's been any recent revisitation of that statistic, but even if it was 10%, it would still be a much smaller share.
What do you see as the effects of domestic abuse on children? Can you sort of pick things out?
There is a 1989 study by researchers Robert Ackerman and Susan Pickering that states that families under stress produce children under stress. If a spouse is being abused and there are children in the house, the children are affected by the abuse. There's obviously a lot of effects. We're dealing with a child's emotional health here. Without sort of trying to build a comparison here that gets a little out of hand, but I sometimes think of domestic abuse like an uncontrolled virus running around the house. And an uncontrolled virus is going to cause all sorts of different physical symptoms in a child. And I think an abusive household with emotional and physical abuse is going to produce different kinds of reactions in the children. So you get emotional, behavioral, social, and physical manifestations in the child. These can include anger, depression, confusion, as I mentioned, about conflicting feelings towards the parents. A lot of shame in the example you gave at the beginning. Girl was very ashamed to have anybody come into her household. Very common feeling. Low self-esteem, just like the victim will have low self-esteem, the child will exhibit the same symptom. Trying to avoid confrontation. You don't want to get involved in this. This is too painful. So you try and keep the peace as much as possible. Difficulty in trusting adults. If you see that your parents don't trust each other, it's very difficult to form bonds and trust. And poor academic performance. Very often, something will come to the forefront in a school because a child's academic performance deteriorates or has been pretty poor all the way through, even though the child may test out as having good capabilities intellectually at being able to learn. In addition, there may be regression in development in younger children. And finally, you get the physical symptoms, headaches, stomach aches. As I say, it's your emotional virus running around the house.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion of the effects of domestic abuse on children. For an audio CD of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015. Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Barbara Zachheim about the effects of domestic abuse on children.
Are the effects on children different when they actually witness domestic physical violence?
I discussed this issue with our case manager and our clinical oversight manager because I really hadn't thought about this. And they both suggested something that was rather interesting. They said that if a child actually witnesses one parent or one partner striking another, it's an action. It has a reaction. Witnessing the effects of that action, actually witnessing a bruise or a cut or something without actually seeing the act, there may be suspicion, and that emotionally may cause some problems, but it's a different reaction. It's more of a passive sort of take on what is going on in the household.
Are they likely to act out? Are they likely to have their own behavior reactions?
There does seem to be more and more evidence that children who witness domestic abuse in the household, particularly boys, are going to be more susceptible to bullying. And bullying at the elementary school level leads to bullying at the middle school level, teen dating violence, and then relationships that become abusive themselves in adulthood.
So it's another side effect of what's going on besides the couple.
It's a growing scenario, yes. The American Bar Association has cited that judges report the appearance of children first encountered by the court as victims in domestic abuse cases reappearing in their courts as juvenile offenders and adult criminal defendants.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just mentioned bullying, so a school seeing something like that should do what?
It's a very good question, and it's a very difficult question to answer in some respects because, as we know, there are a lot of legalities surrounding these kinds of issues. Perhaps the best thing that an educator or a school guidance counselor can do is to call a parent in for a parent-teacher meeting because they may be noticing something in the child that's affecting their education or affecting their behavior. And the guidance counselor has every right, and the educator bringing that information to the counselor has every right to bring the parent in to discuss that. If that guidance counselor is trained in recognizing the signs of what might be an abusive environment, then they will be more likely to be able to recognize those signs when the parent comes into the school. Not all parents are going to sit down and say, oh, by the way, I'm living in an abusive environment. In fact, it's highly unlikely that any parent is going to sit down with a school guidance counselor and make such a confession. But there will be signs in terms of the structure of the household, different things that are going on in terms of the parent's ability to work with the child as an effective parent that may give warning signs to that counselor. Obviously, if the counselor suspects that there is physical abuse of the child, then they have to report that to the authorities. I don't believe there's a state where that would not be an obligation on the school guidance counselor. If they suspect there's physical abuse of the parent, there's nothing they can do except to speak to the parent and see if there's an entree where they can offer the parent some advice about reading materials or talking to a therapist or whatever it may be, if the parent offers that opening for the guidance counselor to give that kind of advice.
Now, especially since there's carryover from generation to generation, apparently, how can we work with our kids and teach them some sort of prevention?
I think in the 21st century, it's about time that we start to look at children's emotional health as part of our public health system and as part of our public educational system. Our pediatricians do the best job they can in taking care of our children's physical health. Most pediatricians have not taken the time or don't have the time or haven't been trained to look into the child's emotional health. And very often, a lot of the physical symptoms that we discussed before, headaches, stomachache, spacing out, withdrawal from social situations, may indicate that there's something that is not right in the child's environment that has nothing to do with that child's physical health. So I think we need to start educating our pediatricians and our public health community that dealing with our children's emotional health could be a wonderful thing in terms of prevention for future generations. Similarly, our educational system, we have school guidance counselors that are there to see if the stress of the SATs are too much and to see if a child who's a bully is causing another child grief, but what is going on in the child's home, as we've already discussed, is not something that is as easy for the counselor to deal with. If they are trained and if teachers are trained in understanding some of the signs of a child experiencing real problems in their emotional health, they may be a first responder in being able to take care of these problems. One of the symptoms of domestic abuse that I didn't mention is that the perpetrator very often uses isolation from family and friends as a tactic. And that is something that very often pediatricians or school guidance counselors could easily find out about. How often do you see your grandparents? Do you have a good relationship with an aunt and uncle? Do you talk to, you know, your mother's friend who's good at needlepoint and you like needlepoint? All sorts of very general questions that aren't being intrusive in terms of what's happening between mummy and daddy that might give some indication that there are some problems out there.
What about having both parents come to school? Do you find in situations where there's an abusive environment that both parents won't come, or maybe both parents don't come or only one parent will come, that kind of thing?
I think in many cases it's very difficult to get either parent to come. The abuser is obviously very into power and control, and he's not going to take notice from a guidance counselor that he has to show up to school to talk about his child. He's in control of his child. Nobody's going to tell him how to bring up his child. Mm. The mother will be suffering from shame, humiliation. She doesn't want to go into school. She might suspect there's a problem with her child, and she's blaming herself. She never blames the abuser. So she's too humiliated. Her self-esteem is so low that to discuss these problems is very, very difficult. So to get either parent to come in may be problematic. Bringing them in together is probably a very bad idea. Most counselors who deal with domestic abuse will tell you that when it comes to providing therapy, you do not bring the two parents together. Another thing that schools may do is invite organizations like the one that I lead to come in and do prevention training for their students. We have a prevention program that deals with healthy relationships, which we provide in middle and high schools. And the idea is for young people to recognize the signs of power and control and even understand if they may already be engaging in an unhealthy relationship.
Well, if you're the parent of a friend of a child where you suspect that something's going on in the home that's not so healthy, is there anything you can do?
You can try and develop a relationship with a child so that they're comfortable coming to your home where you can provide an environment that is safe. You might sort of suggest after-school activities that are in a safe environment that keeps the child more out of the home that is raging with conflict. Obviously, that's going to depend on the age of a child. You can't suddenly take a 2-year-old out of the house and provide an environment unless either parent agrees to that. But if you suspect that your friend is under a pressure of an abusive relationship and you think you can suggest to that friend without sort of saying, I know you're being abused, but you're saying, you seem to be suffering a lot of stress, there's a lot going on, I'm sure, with work and home, and maybe it would be nice if I took care of your little one for the afternoon. Things like that that are very neutral could be a big help in giving the child some greater sense of security than it might be experiencing in his own home.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on the effects of domestic abuse on children.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We're talking with Barbara Zachheim about the effects of domestic abuse on children. Have you seen that commercial that airs about a child being invited to stay for dinner at a friend's house, and he calls home to get permission, and the mother doesn't believe that the whole family is going to be having dinner together at this other house, and the mother has to get on? Turns out it's a commercial for carry-out fried chicken or something like that. But but the point of it, I thought, was very well taken, that so many families don't spend time together. And I would think that that's another symptom, that something's kind of weird if they don't have a meal together, at least sometimes.
Well, I mean, in today's society, an indicator, but it may not be just because of the stresses of two parents working, different schedules and all the rest of it. But in an abusive environment, I would say most children would be very happy if there wasn't a family meal, because knowing that the parents are together is going to induce that conflict, and being part of it is so painful.
What if you're the relative in a situation and you see that the child is in an abusive setting? The child is 7, 8, 9, 10.
It's a very, very difficult situation. In fact, I had a case that came to my doorstep last year. One summer morning, I was sort of dragging myself out of bed about 7 o'clock in the morning, and I heard a knock at the door. And it was a little unusual, so threw on a robe, ran downstairs, opened the door, and there's a young woman standing there in tears with two little children. And she said, "Can you help me? I need your help." And she came in, and without going into a lot of details, she was living in an abusive situation, and it had escalated the night before into an emotionally and highly physically abusive situation, which one of the children had witnessed. And the children were about, I think, 4 and 2 years old. We managed to get this woman some help, and part of that help is she wanted to go to her parents. And so I was put directly in touch with her parents. I brought our case manager in to deal with this, but the parents wanted to talk to me because she had come to my door and I'd spent a few hours with her. And the parents' hands were really tied. They suspected there were problems. They had spoken to their daughter. They had asked her to come and stay with them and have sort of a cooling off period. But their daughter is an adult. They have no control over their adult child, which is one wouldn't expect them to have. And one always asks the question, just like any relative will ask the question, why does she stay? Why does the victim stay? That's always the big question out there. Very few of us, including myself, didn't first start out with the question, why does he abuse? Leaving an abusive relationship is a very, very difficult thing to do, particularly when there are children involved, when you have no financial control over your assets. What are you going to leave with? And the literature, statistics, cases have shown that the gravest danger to the victim is at the time she leaves. Many cases have demonstrated that the victim could be in serious danger, fatal danger, when she leaves. There was a case, I'm sure you will remember, here in the DC area about a year ago, where a couple, she left and he went after her, went into, I believe she worked in a cell phone store, and he set her on fire. And she suffered terrible burns. The case did come to court. There were all sorts of ramifications of that case because of a previous ruling that a judge had made that was a very poor ruling. He had not taken her side in providing an extended protective order. But the bottom line is, it's very dangerous to leave. So how does a parent or a relative get involved besides providing support, letting the person, the victim, know that you are there for them, providing financial resources if the victim requests and needs those resources, and trying to be there even though they may be isolated from those family and friends, which is one of the tactics that the abuser will use.
So how can relatives help then? You just sort of say, gee, that's really a shame. You can come over anytime you want.
Provide the victim information.
We hotline, have, phone number kinds
we have,
of things?
Yeah. In the organization I'm with, we have a hotline, we have a helpline, we have a website. One of the resources that I have provided that will be on your website is the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Counselors there will provide excellent, excellent information for victims. We offer our interested parties who are concerned about somebody who may be being abused, we have what we call little palm cards. They're like little business cards, which we can hand somebody and they can put in their shoe, they can put in an unobtrusive place so that the abuser is not aware that that person is being offered information that could help them. Calling them up on a line that is not secure and saying, oh, I think you've got a problem and I know how to help you, is not the way to handle this problem. We're dealing with threatening situations. We're dealing with a high level of fear. And that mother usually is the one that has to protect herself and protect her children. And it's a very difficult situation for her to do so.
This has been obviously a devastating subject to deal with. But for all of our listeners out there, what kinds of resources would you suggest for people who would like to know more about these issues?
There are a ton of resources out there. I've provided just a few that I found helpful myself. The first, and I think most important, is the information at the National Domestic Violence Hotline. There is a telephone number, 1-800-799-SAFE, and the website is ndvh.org. The Child Welfare Information Gateway has excellent resources. The American Bar Association Commission on Domestic Violence has some very interesting information. My own organization has a web page that gives very useful general information. That's the Jewish Coalition Against Domestic Abuse. http://jakeda.org/www/docs/4. Then there are two books that were recommended to me. The first one I think is very important to break the myth about domestic abuse. It's by Patricia Evans and is called The Verbally Abusive Relationship, How to Recognize It and How to Respond. And this is the second edition that came out in 1996. And the last book is by Tamara Chansky, Freeing Your Child from Anxiety. And since anxiety is going to be one of the signs that a child exhibits, this is particularly good for children demonstrating anxiety and worry and who may have some post-traumatic stress syndrome.
This is a lot to think about, but Barbara Zachheim, thank you so very much for being with us today and helping us to demystify and learn a lot about children living in an environment of domestic abuse. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you for having me. It's not easy to deal with this subject, and I give you a lot of kudos for taking the time to have this on your show.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of The Little Book, a collection of stories and articles, parenting tips and resources for all parents and caregivers, especially those who love and care for children and teens with special needs. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 322 and tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. We would like to thank the American Psychiatric Foundation for their generous support for this particular program, and we need your feedback. Please complete the very brief survey you will find on our website at www.parentsperspective.org in reference to this specific show. We need your input. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.